Today, we're lucky to have Chuck Schobert come and speak for us. He was a 96 graduate of UW-Madison, the vet school, and he spent a long time as a clinician working
All creatures great and small.
Okay. And so now he's back in research, and he's working with Dick, and they're working on eye evolution, and he's going to talk today about fisheye evolution. So thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I work with Dr. Dick DeBiltzing in his lab, and acquired a passion in the last year or so on evolution of the eye, which Dick has encouraged about. So I want to share that today. What I'll be talking about is the comparative ocular morphology of trogomorphic fish, the fish that live in the dark, show you some different species. We're talking a lot about lionfish, partially sighted fish, as well as some sighted fish, and just looking at it from an evolutionary perspective and telling that kind of a story. So we'll go through some stuff. Basic plan is we'll start out with some more primitive eyes and the non-vertebrate chordates. These are the jawless creatures, like the lamprey and the hagfish. Then we'll grab the pointer here and we'll get into talking about the Congo lionfish, Lamprologus lithops, and I'll do a little travelogue piece, and then we'll get into more of the ocular anatomy here. And we've got the hot off the press department right there, literally just this morning, so that's pretty hot. Then we're gonna go from the Congo into Mexico and talk about a system that's been used as a model, a molecular genetics model, that's a Mexican blind cavefish. And we'll do a very brief travelogue on that, look at the ocular anatomy, and I'll speak a little bit to the model system, but I'm more, much more of an anatomist than I am a molecular geneticist, so I'll try to answer those kind of questions. And we'll just end with some chances for discussion, I hope, and speculations about what this all really means. So I don't know how well-versed people are in the eye. Dick spoke last month, and I don't want to overdo it, but I just wanted to show this very schematic representation of a teleost eye, and it's an advanced fish. We'll start with some primitive aquatic creatures, but this is an advanced eye, and just wanted to give you a basic overview of some of the structures. Obviously a lens, and then there's a retina right along here, feeds into the optic nerve, and everything's kind of encapsulated in what's called a sclera. Not shown on here, the teleosts generally have some cartilage inside the sclera to give a little bit more structural firmness. And we've got, we've got the vitreous humor, we've got something called the falciform process, which nourishes the retina. And not shown in this picture is a choroid gland out here. And it's not a gland per se, it's more like a microcapillary bed that feeds oxygen and nutrients in from the gills. So the retina is a huge energy hog. Gram for gram, it is using more energy than the brain. So there are all these strategies that have evolved with evolution to feed that that retina. So that's the basic structure of it. I should mention the choroid as well, that sort of orange-brown part. There's also vessels, capillaries in there. So there's a lot of, different devices for keeping the retina and its photoreceptors happy. All right, just to say where we are, I want to show where we're gonna start. We'll start with the prevertebrate chordates, then we'll move up the tree and then go out into the fish branch where the teleosts are. So, spend most of the talk talking about the teleosts, and then a little bit on the more primitive eye before we get there. So, this is just comparing the two primitive prevertebral chordates that I'm gonna talk about, looking at how some people feel they have evolved or diverged over the millennia. There's some controversy here about which diverged and how this happened, but it seems like the prevailing view in the literature that I've run across is that the hagfish diverged prior to the lampreys and then evolved into the jawed vertebrates. As I mentioned, neither of these has a jaw. There's another theory that says that the hagfish actually diverged out of the lamprey clade. So that there's a lot of controversy, as you probably know, about where some of these the relatedness of some of these different creatures, and the terminology is mind-boggling. So sometimes it's very hard to compare papers because I'm not sure that they're talking about the same thing. So that is a problem. That's my caveat. Here's a comparison of the hagfish and the lamprey, very beautiful creatures. Hagfish has gills, has these mucus glands, which I'll mention later. Down here, the lamprey has gills as well. There have not been any fossil records that I'm aware of the hagfish, but there have been two putative lamprey fossil finds. That's expected too. So a little bit about the background on these two critters, and they don't have fins, you probably noticed that, neither pectoral or pelvic. They have a notochord that persists for life, no scales, and the axons of the neurons are unmyelinated. Lampreys have both an innate immune system and an adaptive immune system, but it's very different than what we see in the jawed vertebrates. And I just put that in there because I want to point out, as maybe everyone knows, and I'm preaching to the choir, that along with the eyes evolving, of course, all sorts of other things are happening, both related to the eye and unrelated as well. All right, this is the lovely hagfish here. People eat these, more on that later. You can see that there's a little spot here, and we'll look at that in more detail, but the eye is underneath that translucent area of skin. Their niche is to eat dead whales and other things that fall down to the ocean floor. I always didn't think dead whales would sink, but what do I know about that? They secrete this incredible amount of slime, and this is what I think is kind of cool. Here's a picture of that. It's amazing. As I mentioned, they live in these very deep oceanic trenches. We're talking about more than 100 meters down, waiting for the whales to fall. And if you're bored, tired of studying, whatever, this is a real recommendation. Go on YouTube, Eddie and the Hagfish, not a rock band, but it could be. Eddie spends about 5 minutes telling you the glories of the hagfish, and actually really very informative, and not just gross mucus, but you get to hear a lot about and see a lot of stuff about mucus, and you get to see one of these things feeding, not in a whale, sorry, but it's not for the faint, the upset stomach person, the light stomach person. Don't go there without that warning. Those are the eyes of the hagfish. As I mentioned, there's this translucency in the skin, and I put an arrow there so I remember that that's where the eye is. They're very primitive eyes. Some people like to put the eye part in quotes, but they have a lot of structures that make them look like sort of precursors to a vertebrate eye. So no cornea though, no lens as we'd see in a vertebrate eye. They have a retina, but it's only two neuronal layers as opposed to vertebrates, which have generally three. No melanin pigments, very primitive photoreceptors. And their photoreceptors are wired to the brain like a pineal gland, and they don't have a pineal gland. And then also, because it's a two-layered retina, the photoreceptors synapse directly onto the ganglion cells, which feed into the optic nerve, and then onto the hagfish brain. Just for orientation purposes, Mara asked me to put this in. This is not a hagfish, it's a more tasty fish. I think it's a trout. The point I want to make here is that in the following slides, I'm going to show a lot of histology sections where we have made some slices in this orientation. So how we create those is we take the tissue, it's been fixed in formalin, and then we infiltrate that or embed it in paraffin. The paraffin hardens. We send it to some people that are highly skilled at taking thin 5-micron slices. Then we slap those onto a slide, or at least they do, and then we stain them with various types of stains. But this is the orientation that you'll be seeing as we go through, and so hopefully that will make things a little clearer. All right, the hagfish eye in histological section. So over here, we've got what's called a subrose. We get the whole creature, at least the head part, in the slide, almost. Missed out here. You see the eye up there, and you get an idea of sort of the relative size of the eye compared to the rest of the animal. The other eye is not in this picture, probably because the plane of section didn't cut through it. So we try our best to make good transverse sections, but things shift and so on in the block as you're preparing it, and you just give it your best shot. This is apparently the mouth and some olfactory organs. And we'll talk more about that later. You'll see some of the other fish, how olfactory sensation becomes more, is thought to become much more of a player in terms of living in a dark environment. So this is another kind of stain of the hagfish eye, showing that there is actually some material inside that's analogous to or is a vitreal humor, a fluid that's in there. This is not a lens, I'm not sure what it is. You see there's a retina and some photoreceptors here. there's some collagen, and then it is covered with some skin. Down here, just a little higher magnification, showing the retina and showing that there's not a true cornea here, but there is an optic nerve coming off. And again, plain of section, we don't have anything longer than that. And just showing again the two layers of cells, photoreceptors down there, dangling down, and then two layers feeding into the optic nerve. So moving from the hagfish to the lamprey eye, lamprey is interesting because it takes 5 years to develop to the adult form. It spends most of the 5 years, I'm not sure how many, buried in mud, which doesn't sound too exciting. So initially, it's a lot like the hagfish. It doesn't have a lens. It's very similar to the hagfish eye. The eye is covered in skin as the hagfish is. So here's the larval eye from the lamprey, and this is the brain, and then you see the two eye sockets, eye cups, orbits. In higher magnification, you can see that this is actually a developing eye, still covered with skin here, but you'll see the lens is actually not really differentiated totally. There's still epithelial cells doing their job, making lens fiber proteins, and then the retina kind of curls around here and generally is not really differentiated. There is one spot in the bow retina that's developed at this time, and you can see some photoreceptors here and some of the layering starting. I don't know the chronological placement of this in terms of the 5 years that I mentioned earlier, but it's still a larval form. The adult, on the other hand, is pretty cool. It's got a cornea, and that's pretty much continuous with the skin. There are no muscles of accommodation, as we have in our eye, to help focus the lens and that sort of thing. But it has most of the vertebrate eye structures. It's got a lens, it's got three neuronal layers in the retina, it's got extraocular muscles, so it can look around for fish to attach to. It is wired to the brain like a visual eye, and it's got melanin. It's got pigment in the choroid and in the retinal pigment epithelium, or RPE. It has color vision, and it has a pineal gland. And so here's the adult, beautiful sections, beautiful eye. You see this very robust retina back here, a nice lens. You see the iris and the cornea, which basically continues with the skin. And here's just a close-up of the retina, seeing the photoreceptors, the RPE, choroid, and several layers of the retina. This is an artifact of the section, most likely. Here's another prettier stain that shows, again, what a cornea would look like. You've got a scleral layer, you've got an epithelial layer that crosses the top. Here's your iris and the end of the retina lens peeking into the picture. Also, I think this is the annular ligament. We don't know what it does, but the teleost fish have this annular ligament, and that'll crop up a little bit later on. I have a better picture of that down the road. This complicated slide is only here to show that the hagfish has only one photoreceptor, whereas you move up to the lamprey, and you've got the full complement of basically of vertebrate photoreceptors. So again, time marches on, and evolution marches on, and things are getting more complicated. So the messages here are that, you know, these are probably some really early signs of the evolution of the vertebrate eye. So in the hagfish primitive eye, it's reminiscent of a vertebrate eye precursor, but it's thought that it mainly has a circadian function, whereas the lamprey has an image-forming camera-type eye, very vertebrate-like. So the controversy I mentioned earlier is just the divergence from where did the hagfish diverge? And I think I went over that before. I think it's still thought that mainly diverged prior to the lamprey on the tree. And then, of course, if you're interested, after you watch Eddie and the Hagfish, you can use these fish for something. People actually do eat these fish. I don't know if you call them fish, but they call them fish. Hagfish and lamprey are eaten by people around the world. But this recipe I got off the internet, and I have not been able to find 6 tablespoons of hagfish slime. So if anybody could help me, I'd really appreciate that. But I have one more recipe, lamprey bordelais, and I got this off the internet too, and it says the difficulty is medium. So you know how they do those recipes, that I thought maybe I could handle medium, but again, I haven't been able to find any lampreys that I can do that. I'm not sure my wife would let me do it in our kitchen anyway. So that's that. So on to the Congo, the lower Congo River in particular. We've been collaborating with the American Museum of Natural History, and they've been great about giving us information and fish specimens. So this next section of the talk will be looking at that. The Congo River is something that the American Museum has taken a special interest to, and I'll go into that in more detail. I highly recommend that if you have time to go to the American Museum's website, they have a tab for the Congo Project, which talks a lot about this setup where the ichthyology department at the American Museum has assembled an American, you know, stateside team and a Congolese team, and they're doing some really excellent work describing the river, the depth and the fish that live there and so on. So it's quite interesting. I'll show some more things about that. But of our immediate interest, this is the blind depigmented or albino fish, Lamprologus lathops, and this is its congener or sister fish, Lamprologus tigropictolus. And so we have sectioned through into some of these, both of these fish. Let's look at the blind one first, the non-pigmented fish. It's a benthic fish, which means it, we think it lives most of its life on the bottom of the Congo River. In this particular shows what's called gas bubble disease. Fish do get the bends, and this fish is thought to live in some trenches in the Congo River that are as deep as 700 feet. So for whatever reason, they get washed up to the surface. There's never been one of these found alive, actually. Well, they're either dead or they're dying or in the last death throes, probably because of this or some other illness that makes them come up to the surface and the gas bubble disease finishes them off. So that's important to remember, that they haven't been found alive and studied in an aquarium like some of the other fish I'll mention. Another important piece here is that the, you can see the little spots hopefully out there, or take my word for it. Those are where the eyes are located more dorsally now, on the midline. And they've moved from, the sighted fish usually have their eyes more on the side. So since they've migrated up to the top, that's consistent with it being a bottom feeding or benthic fish. And also suggests to us that we have, we could find, or there may be, some intermediate forms that have eyes in different positions. So those have not been found yet, but it's just a good question to put out there, a hypothesis. And the other thing before I go to the next slide is that the local Congolese people refer to this fish as Mondele Biro, which the translation has been told to me means white man at a desk. You can figure out what it might be. I found this, the world's best boss. So I'll get one of those mugs for Dick, but this is a different boss. And move on to the Congo River, the travelogue portion of the talk. And I just want to make the impression that this is a really cool river. It's a really wild place. And it's a very beautiful river, and I'd like to go there someday and see it. So many rivers are dammed heavily that I don't think there are any rivers, or very few rivers that actually go to the sea without being dammed. And this has some dams as well, although I can't give you details. As far as I know, there aren't any dams on the Lower Congo River, but there are quite a bit of different sort of flows to the river, different scenes. The river is amazing in its depth. It's the deepest river in the world, going down 500 to 700 feet. It has been studied, like I said, by the American Museum people, and it's an ongoing project where they're measuring things like the flow of the water. So for example, this river will be flowing really rapidly on the surface, and you go 20 feet down, it's flowing in the same speed in the other direction. There are underwater waterfalls in this river. There is a place in the river where there's a wall of water that essentially divides the one shore from the other shore, and they have the museum people and their collaborators have sampled the populations on either side of the river, either from either bank, and they've been able to show that there are significant genetic changes between the fish in terms of mutations, point mutations, and that stuff. So they've working that out and bring a lot of molecular genetics on the fish in this river, trying to really figure out a precise phylogenetic tree. And I'm not going to talk about that, but maybe someday. The next slide I want to show is a video that Scott Ernest helped me put into this. This PowerPoint, since I'm sort of computer impaired. And what it shows basically is just some more scenes in the Congo. You get whirlpools, the American Museum people hired world-class kayakers to come in and work their way down the river, and some of them were carrying like depth, I don't know, you call them depth sounders or sonar or whatever, so they could map the terrain, the topography of the bottom. How deep is it? How fast is the river flowing in different points? And how does it relate to what fish are found where, and possibly to evolutionary changes? This is just a huge river full of microhabitats where there's a lot going on. So hopefully this will work, and we'll see. Starting out an airplane. Okay, so this is the mighty Congo whirlpools, and this man's going to apparently catch some fish for the museum or for himself. Lots of rapids. And here's just a sampling of the fish. None that I'm going to talk about today, but you might have some in your aquarium at home. I particularly like that one. Here's the whitewater kayakers in action. Looks like they're having fun. I kayak, but this is way beyond my abilities. So, looks like fun though. This is Mondalli Bureau, Lamprologus lithops, the main focus of what we're going to talk about. You get an idea of the size by the man holding it. So what's cool about the Congo River, I mentioned some of it, that's just so many habitats. I mean, it's an amazing place to study fish and try to look at some of the stages as fish evolve. And we were talking about this morning, Dick and I, just how many genes are out there and how many variants there are and what must be going on in these different habitats. So there's a lot of, you can imagine these habitats as being places where there's different kinds of selective pressure. So that's kind of an exciting thing. With evolution, well, it is occurring all the time, but it's really an exciting study here in this particular river. And there are weird fish here, so that's kind of attractive to me, particularly like this one. But here are the fish we're going to really be looking at today, the blind Lamprologus lithops, and then sister species, the pigmented sighted version. So these are histology sections, like I mentioned before, staying with hematoxylin and eosin. And we've got the sighted Jigralopithecus, mouthful for me, and the lithops, blind fish. So just to point out a few features of that, here you've got enormous eyes, well-formed iris, and you've got a nice retina. You have a choroid gland here, muscles here. You've got this annular ligament right here along the cornea. So if you go over to the other fish, the blind fish, you see tiny eyes, and you just notice that the eyes have moved dorsally. So they're much smaller, and they become dorsal along the midline of the fish. And there's a lot of wide open space here where there's just nothing. So what that means, we do not know. Here are some higher magnification images of the blind fish, the lithops eye. And you can see a couple things here. The lens looks pretty well formed. There's a retina. The choroid that I mentioned earlier has been pretty well filled up with adipose tissue. It's very rich in adipose tissue, which is something we don't usually see. If you look at it a little bit closer, you can see there's some cartilage in the sclera, and you can see there is a lot of adipose tissue in there. But the most interesting feature of this fish, at least to me, is that it's covered with bone and skin. There's no ocular opening like other fish. And then the lens, as I mentioned, is appropriate for the size of the eye, although the way the anatomy is sort of truncated here, it may look a little bit like it's overly large. And that's just a view of the retina. Your photoreceptors down here, retinal pigmented epithelium, and then the different layers of photoreceptor cells and processing cells, and then other cells that would potentially feed into an optic nerve. Don't see an optic nerve here. In this particular specimen, we only took a few sections. We did not do what's called step sectioning, where you go through down and just do every layer, kind of like a layer cake, to see if you can find particular structures. This is just a sample, so we might be missing out on some structures in this. We are trying to, we have some more specimens that have come in of this fish and some others, which I'll mention later, and we are going to be doing some step sectioning through the fish. This does not have a choroidal gland. I'll mention that as well. In the sighted fish, everything's different. You've got a cornea, and you've got the iris, and a very nice retina, choroidal gland. And here you see a very nice picture of the ganglion cells feeding their processes into the optic nerve. Close up of the choroidal gland. It's chock full of red blood cells, but didn't show up too well in this particular view. But again, it's a strategy for feeding the retina. Needs a lot of energy. We've done a little bit of immunohistochemistry on some of the opsins in this, in these two fish from the Congo. In the sighted fish, you see their photoreceptors look pretty structurally sound. In rhodopsin, they stain positive for rhodopsin. In the blind fish, there's a positive stain for rhodopsin as well, but the photoreceptors look very disorganized and atrophied, as does the retina here. You compare the two, sighted, blind. Sighted, nice layered structure. The blind looks very degenerate and disorganized. We plan to do some further work on that down the line. Okay, this is the hot off the press department, and I'll see if I can relate what this is. We got some more specimens from the American Museum, other than the fish I just showed you. One of them is called Mastocembulus burcardi. It's so new I can't even pronounce it. But at any rate, we got two samples of this species from them, a small size one and a larger size one. I guess that's how we described it. The way they described it to us is that the small one had no eyes, or it's eyeless, that's how the museum people described it, and the larger one of the same genus species had vestigial eyes. So what we did was, with this so-called eyeless form or morph, we did some step sections through it, 84 step sections. We didn't find any eye structures, no optic nerve, no globe, nothing. So it seemed to bear that maybe this is indeed an eyeless form. Then we got the larger form back today, and it had been sectioned. And in fact, it has an eye that has some very, very, it has an eye, and the eye has a retina and structures that you'd expect to see, but it's very small. So I mentioned the depigmented eyeless one. The second one has got a fully developed lens, retina, an incomplete cornea, and the eyes are somewhat dorsally displaced, as we saw in the earlier blind fish that I was talking about, the lithops. So what we're going to do is we're going to go back and do some further sectioning of the small form and see if we can find any eye structures that might be in there. And what could be going on here? There's a lot of speculation you can make. It could be a situation where the so-called eyeless specimen is an earlier form of the larger and older specimen. So it'd be sort of a developmental situation from junior to senior, kind of like the lamprey in a certain sense. Or maybe there aren't any eyes at all in the eyeless form, and in fact, the specimen, the larger specimen that has eyes, tiny eyes, is something that maybe came about due to sort of a hybrid between some fish that have sight and an eyeless type. We don't know, and what we're going to do to find out is to section more through the eyeless fish and see if we can find anything there, and continue to do some sectioning through the larger fish and see what we can find out. What's really more interesting to me in a way is where these are found. They're not found 700 feet down, they're not found in caves, but they're collected, these two forms or morphs collected in the same sort of locality, and they live under boulders and rocks. So they're not exactly cave fish, they're not exactly trench living, so they're in a place where they see light. So that's a little bit of a mystery too. That's just what the museum people told us, so I don't have any more information about that. So now I think we'll travel to Mexico, and this is a better characterized system in terms of molecular genetics. Astyanax mexicanus is the Mexican blind cavefish, and what's really cool about this is that in the same species you have a blind and a sighted morph. And another thing that's nice about it is that these are fairly recently diverged as well. Estimates range from, well, they seem to center around 1 million years ago when these two forms split. There's obviously debate on that, as there is in most of the literature. So it's become a really excellent model system for looking at development and looking at molecular genetics, and that's been really advanced by Dr. Bill Jeffries at the University of Maryland and many others. I'm not going to say a lot about that. We'll talk more about the differences in the ocular anatomy between the blind and sighted forms. But I want to show you the size of a mature adult here. This is Dr. Leandro Teixeira, who's a fellow in our lab. and he's holding the forceps a mature adult. 6 months, 4 to 6 months of maturity. These things are great to grow in the lab and do studies. You can watch the eye develop. You can watch the eye regress in the blind form. It's a great lab tool and model system. But I think we always have to keep in mind that it's a model system. It's not out in the Congo River. It's not in a cave in Mexico. It's in the lab. And this is Dr. Teixeira, who we know is a mature adult, and he is older than 6 months. So I am pretty sure about that. But he did take these fantastic pictures. He's got a lot of talents, and this is one of them. This is the sided Mexican fish, and you can see that it's got eyes on the side, lateral eyes, pigment, and the eyes are pretty large, which is not unusual. The blind fish, no pigment, and gosh, no eyes to be seen in this view anyway. And that's the cave habitat. This is the travelogue portion, and it's a stupid slide, but the purpose that's there is because I want to just make the point that not all caves are alike. And so there's something like 82 caves in Mexico where the Astyanax has been collected. So if you're trying to compare, you know, fish from cave A with the fish from cave, you know, M, it may not be as identical as you think. And in fact, the different amount of light, the light changes in different caves. Some of them have skylights, some have wider mouths. There's a lot of debate about how these fish came to be in the caves, and so that's not settled. How did they lose their eyes? There's a lot of questions about that. So I think I'm posing more questions than answers. So maybe that's what education is about. But that's the cave habitat. I just want people to keep in mind that whether it's the Congo River or a Mexican cave or some trenches, it's not a homogeneous situation. Maybe that's just stating the obvious. So as far as evolutionary and developmental work, it's a great system. And the molecular genetics are well known. I don't believe it's the entire genome has been sequenced, to my knowledge, but many genes have been identified. It's easy to study the development of the eye and under the scope, and you can see the eye developing, and you can see the lens cells begin to undergo apoptosis, and you'll see the eye start to degenerate. They're handy, as I mentioned, because they reproduce rapidly, 4 to 6 months generation time. And they've done some people have done interesting lens transplant experiments where they'll take a lens from a sighted Mexican fish and they have transplanted it into the degenerate eye of a blind Mexican fish, and then the eye will develop to what looks like a full-fledged normal eye. The reverse is also true. If you take a blind fish lens and transplant it into the orbit of into the eye of a sighted fish, you'll see a degeneration of that eye. So what these experiments tell us, among other things, is that the genes for eye development are still present. They haven't gone away. They're still present, and when you trigger them, when you hit the on-off switch, whatever that is, then you can get them to do their jobs and create the proteins that they were set up to do. So what this has been called, among other things, is pleiotropy, where, say, a single gene controls two or more different genes downstream. So in this fish, some researchers believe and have identified switch genes that, for example, will enhance taste buds, will enhance mechanoreception in the fish, but will, at the same time, downregulate eye development genes. So it would seem that if you could put selection pressure on an off switch in some way, and there are many different ways people suggest, then you would end up losing the eyes, essentially. They wouldn't develop, but you would enhance the taste buds and enhance the mechanoreception, which is handy when you are in a dark place. So the next slide shows some of the ocular anatomy. Again, these are dorsal ventral. Here's the sided one, pretty much obviously. And big lens, beautiful retina, that kind of thing. And the annular ligament I mentioned is here, and that comes into play more with this fish than the other ones. If you look at the blind fish, you see several things. One is the eyes are smaller. There's still what looks like a pretty mature lens. There's no lens seen here, but again, it's plane of section. You know, we do our best to try to include everybody, but it doesn't happen all the time. The other thing that happens here with this fish is that since these eyes are smaller, more or less degenerate eyes, the skin tends to start to fold over the orbit. And it's not shown here in our specimen, we didn't see it, but some people have reported that bone will begin to form here, but I have seen no pictures of that. But what this does, what some people speculate this does, is that this opens up space for other things. And I would point to this as a possible example of increased olfactory apparatus. I'm not an expert on fish anatomy, and maybe somebody else is here, but that's how I'm interpreting this. The idea that you're losing the eyes, really, and you have to rely on other senses is a popular idea in the literature. Some higher mags of the same blind fish, showing that there is, in this one, a choroid gland. You do have the folding of skin, but the annular ligament, for reasons that are unknown, crosses this chasm and got some cartilage, and then it looks like the skin starts to grow over the orbit itself. If you look at the retina, it's very disorganized and not sure if it's functional, although Dr. Jeffries told me that when they do the lens transplant experiments, and they put a lens from a sighted fish into a blind fish, that some of those fish that have recovered their eye structure can see, and in a minimal way, they can sense patterns. But that hasn't been published, and so I've seen no details of that. This is just a higher magnification of those last pictures, just showing epithelium, some collagen, and then this is the annular ligament here, with the lens down there. Sighted fish, of course, very different, with much larger eyes, lateral eyes, and you see the annular ligament here is nice and quiet in its own little cubby hole tucked in front of the iris. And you've got a very nice, nicely layered retina with the photoreceptors, and you can see the choroidal gland better in this picture, maybe, as well. But it's a very different looking retina than in the blind fish. So, implication for evolution, and there's a lot of implications, so I just put down a few, and you can think of a lot more. One thing this shows us is that evolution is not always forward or constructive, that sometimes things seem to go one step forward and two steps back. So, some researchers and the literature will say regressive evolution definitely occurs, and they'll point to the Mexican cavefish as one example. And I mentioned the idea, of course, that different habitats will produce varied selection pressures. So Darwin puzzled with this for a long time, but basically sort of the overview idea is just that by small changes you can move to a situation where the eye is no longer there and you've got an enhancement in some other structures. You've got better olfaction, better mechanoreception, and in some of the cavefish they've shown that in a short time the craniofacial structure changes, so they can go from being surface feeders to bottom feeders, so they can scoop rather than snap. And that happens in the lab, and they've shown it even in some of the rift lakes in East Africa, where the craniofacial structure will change in two generations because of the pollution that's getting poured into those lakes and the turbidity that's increased. So I'm not going to say much more about that particular thing, except to mention this. Some people don't believe regressive evolution occurs. They don't like the term. The American Museum people don't like the term. I don't know. Sometimes it feels sort of semantic to me as I begin to learn about this area. But the idea of phenotypic plasticity is sort of the nature-nurture thing, where the phenotype is the product of, you know, genotype and also the environment. So one experiment that was interesting to me were these light-dark experiments, where they took surface epigean Asteonyx larvae. They're one day old. They put one group in darkness for 30 days and one group in light, normal light, for 30 days and compared. And they found that in the eyes that were on the larvae that were raised in darkness, there were much less development of the eye structures, much more vestigial, you might say. So the point of this is just that there are, you know, some different pathways that you can imagine or start to imagine and maybe recreate in the lab, obviously, that are affected by the environment. So spin-offs. People might say, well, that's great, nice pictures, interesting, so why develop a morphological catalog of blind or partially sighted fish? Well, we'd like to be able to relate some of the morphological differences that we see to genome differences. And we, in our lab, do not do genetic things. We look at the anatomy. And so we would like to collaborate and work with people that do genetic stuff And the American Museum has done some of the molecular genetics in some of these fish, but nothing to the extent that's been done in, say, the Mexican cavefish or the zebrafish, which is kind of the model system. So we'd like to be able to catalog these differences. For example, in the Congo fish, it'd be really very interesting to have a range of forms and be able to speculate something about how those forms might have come to be. Darwin talked about gradations. You might be able to see the morphology change and make some suggestions from that about what's going on. But tying that morphology to the genetics would be something we'd like to do more of. So if you can point us in that direction, that would be great. It also would help us, when we're looking at the wild fish, maybe speculate on some of the mechanisms that are going on there. I just want to thank a lot of people, Dr. Dick DeBilzig, and then the people at the Museum of American Museum of Natural History, Dr. Melanie Stassny and her many colleagues, Dr. William Jeffrey at the University of Maryland. Both those different people sent us samples that we're able to use in the lab and that you've seen. Dr. Ivan Schwab is kind of the man, the go-to guy if you need unusual eyes. And then, I don't know if they're here, but Dr. Tachera and Dr. Dreyfus are fellows in our lab who've done a lot of things to keep things going. And then I mentioned Scott Ernest, who helped me put the video in, which I really appreciated. Kate Lieber is our lab manager, and Janice Locken at the UW Hospital is the histologist that makes these incredibly beautiful images for us of unusual eyes. And then she is, in my experience, the best I've ever seen. So we're lucky to have her doing this. She does a great job. And I'll end with this tree. And so any questions, any speculations, any corrections, whatever, that's it.
So I'll just say one thing of clarification with the with regard to the fish this morning. I'm the one that's worked with it. So we have the two either the same species or similar species, one of which is supposed to have a vestigial eye and the other one is supposed to have a, supposed to be eyeless. And we did in fact find the vestigial eye in the fish that's supposed to have a vestigial eye. But in going back and comparing the head morphology in the areas that we sectioned, the area in the head where the vestigial eye is in that fish, we haven't yet sampled in the other one. We made 84 samples through the tissue that we had and almost cut through the whole block, but we were approaching but haven't yet gotten to the area of the head where the eye is. So don't hold your breath on that. That story may change.
Thanks, Dick. Other questions or other comments? Yes, sir.
So I'm curious about the section that you had before you started talking about the Mexican model system. You had a species where you have, they're essentially the same, the guys that live under the boulders and stuff.
I'm right, right.
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, what Dick was just talking about, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, then I took that one before that.
Okay,
sorry.
Right.
One of the things that you showed was some really disorganized photoreceptors.
Right.
And the other one had really nice ones.
Yes.
What was the age comparison on those two? Is that ever something that you see being an issue with?
That's a really good question. And so one of the problems with collecting it in the wild, it's a pretty obvious one, is it's not always possible to age the fish.
Right.
So a good question. I wish I could tell you more. I do know that the blind fish comes in a range of sizes, but I don't know what that really means in terms of chronological age. You saw the man holding it in his hand.
Right.
Well, whatever, it ranges from, maybe 19 centimeters. It'd be really long to much, much shorter. So it's quite a
little differences, though, shouldn't account for that discrepancy in the organization.
Yep.
When you find the mindless and the ones that are in the same species, I assume they're always in different habitats? Or do you find sometimes,
You're talking about the Congo fish or the Mexican fish, or maybe both?
Whichever one you said had both. It doesn't matter.
The simple answer is, yeah, they're in different habitats. So, for example, the Mexican cavefish, you've got the same species. One amorph is found in the cave, and one is found on the surface. So very different habitats. That's the simple answer to that question, that part of the question. In the Congo fish, the two that I talked about the most, the sighted fish is found near the surface, where there's light, and the blind fish is suggested to live at the bottom of some of these trenches, 500, 700 feet down. But nobody actually can say for sure. I'm not a scuba person, but I don't think you can go that deep in scuba. So anyway, nobody knows absolutely for sure, but they do know that it's when they find the blind fish, it's right over those chasms. So yeah, that it lives in a very different habitat, whether it's all the way down on the bottom, that we suggested by the morphology, or whether it's partway down, I don't know. But there it lives in an environment, whether it's very little or no light.
So I take it in the lab you can cross the fish, but in the wild they never make them?
Well, yeah, yes. You can certainly, and they certainly have been crossed in the lab, not the Congo fish, but the zebra fish and the Mexican blind fish. Crosses have been done. That work has been done. Some other more molecular-oriented genetics has been done as well. In the wild, it seems like, say in the Congo River, for example, you know, you've got all these little habitats, and unless they're blocked, for some reason, flow of water or water temperature or oxygenation or something, then you can certainly imagine like interbreeding of different types, different morphs, and have traits passed on that way.
So what happens when you cross a blind fish with a sight?
You get, let's see, I knew someone asked me that. You do get some sighted fish out of that, out of the F1 cross. And I can't remember, I'd have to look it up, when you get some blind fish out of that cross as well. I don't remember.
So is one the sighted is dominant over the...
I'd have to look it up. I don't know. It's a really good question. So, there's been in the lab. That you can watch that. Obviously, and it's a nice way to look at genetics. So those things have been done, and I just don't have all the information on that. But it's a lot of literature out there that would explain that better than I can. Yeah.
I also have a question about the Astyanax, where you had both mentioned the blind and sighted in the same species. The example you showed, there was a loss of pigmentation in the blind one, beyond the eye. Is that typical?
Yes, that is typical, that they lose the pigmentation as well in these fish.
I guess I was wondering about, I've heard, I think, previously this semester, and in general, about the role of sight in mating behavior and whether...
Right.
Anybody who's looking at the relationship between the pigmentation of the fish and the sight.
Well, that raises a lot of interesting questions about how fish find each other in the dark. I guess I'd start off by speaking to that question by saying that with the pigmentation, again, the pigmentation and the amount of vision have been, by some researchers, correlated with how much light is, say, in the cave. So if you've got fish that are collected closer to the mouth of a cave versus fish that are collected farther back, you'll see some differences. You'll see more pigmentation closer to the mouth of the cave where there's a little more light, and you tend to see slightly larger eyes. But there have been, conflicting studies on that. As to how they find each other and mate, I don't have a great answer to that, but I think that I would say with the enhancements of the olfaction and the mechanoreception that could help overcome the eye situation. I don't. The only other thing I know about the Mexican blind cavefish is that it's not supposed to school. So that's sort of counter to what I just said. They don't travel in the school, so you might say, well, they're not aware of each other. But there may be some other reason for that that fishologists, ichthyologists can tell me. Yes.
So I had another question. Sorry about the lens transplant experiments.
Right.
It's kind of amazing that would work.
I thought so too.
Yeah, because it shouldn't. I don't know. So what I was going to ask is how much is known. I mean, that almost sounds like if the cells undergoing apoptosis in the lens, which you'd say said that someone characterized, is sending a signal to the rest of the eye, hey boys, we need it.
Right.
Whereas if you go the other way around, that signal isn't being sent. Is there any information about the development in terms of the lens signaling back or cells around the lens signaling back to the rest of the eye?
You mean you're talking about some kind of a transduction element
something.
From the lens to the rest of the eye?
I know that sounds ridiculous.
No, it doesn't. And I'm glad you brought that up. I, I don't know for sure what that transduction element could be. I think that there's lens protein, there's different things that could do that. So that's possible. Some people will say that the lens is not the controller, or that in fact it really only has a say in the front part of the eye in terms of the development of, say, the iris, the cornea, that kind of thing, and that some other mechanism is going on in the posterior portion of the eye. So again, I keep running into this conflict in the literature where either the experiment hasn't been done or someone's done the experiment with maybe a different population of fish. And so in my mind right now, there is some conflict about that, what the lens does. And maybe someone else can speak to that more.
I don't know if it's related, but I know in humans, sometimes one of your eye is, you know, we can be quite different.
Yes.
And the brain will shut one down.
Huh, okay.
So it's a fairly common thing, actually. And they train, what happens to people is they will shut the good eye to force the bad eye to work.
Right.
But it could be something like that.
Right.
Where if you put a, you know, if you change things, then it's not, you know, everything is functional. It's just that if your two eyes are quite different
right.
when you're young,
right.
Your brain will just use one because it can't use the, you know, kind of just to pull out, you know, to the bifocal.
That's interesting. That's, I don't know about the human studies. I've read in the Mexican cavefish one study which showed that the brain size did change, in fact, within the blind fish. It was different, and they could reproduce that, claim to reproduce that in the lab. It wasn't the one eye versus the other situation. It was just that obviously if you've got an eye, you've got to have some processing apparatus to deal with it. So I don't know about the human situation, but that's something that is seen in fish in terms of, I don't know, how you would process the information, I guess.
Right, the point is everything is functional,
right.
But it's not working.
It's not working, it's shut down, right.
So I've actually seen Dr. Jeffries talk, and I know that he's linked it to Sonic Hedgehog signaling.
That's right.
So I think there's expression of Sonic Hedgehog
right.
in the lens.
Okay, yeah, thanks for saying that. I know about the Sonic Hedgehog is produced, and that's sort of the on-off gene that people speculate. I didn't know that it was what was thought to be the lens transduction.
I think, I'm not sure, but I know I've read papers on the Sonic Hedgehog signal.
Yes, I didn't bring up the Sonic Hedgehog by name, but thank you for adding that. I appreciate it. And I don't know what the messenger is from the lens, and that's a good question. We'll find out. Yeah.
He's showed a number of different sections where there was some asymmetry between the two sides, which
right.
you were pretty quick to attribute to technical limitations of getting
right.
exactly the right plane.
Right.
But I wonder whether there was any evidence for increased biological asymmetry in the cases of the blind fish. You know, are the eyeballs just simply free to develop a little more asymmetrically in the organisms?
Well, when we in these limited examples, when we step section through them, they don't seem asymmetrical. Like the one fish I showed has a lens. They seem approximately the same size, not like they're developing in different asymmetrical, not developing asymmetrically. I don't know, Dick, have you seen any differences with?
Well, we have very, very small numbers of samples, so we can only speak firsthand about the samples that we have. It's a little, and it's hard for me to get a handle on the morphology of the people that's been done by the people that studied it. The specimen that we had, a lot of the work about the development of the eye is centered around the lens, and it's centered around the concept that the lens is very poorly developed in the Mexican blind fish. But in our specimen, the lens is quite robust and well developed. When we queried about that, they said, "Oh yeah, well that happens too." So I'm just a little bit worried that the sections that they made were not step sectioned. And another thing that makes me worry about that is we shared our image of the one that you're talking about where it appeared to be asymmetrical, and they said, see, your specimen is asymmetrical as well, whereas in fact, you know, we could have taken a picture of the other eye that looked exactly like the the...
So I wonder if you compare, I don't know enough anatomy to even identify any other structure in your histology, but
so,
you know, could
so
you could you look at the asymmetry in the eyes relative to asymmetry in something else you can see in those?
Yeah, well, we can't speak about asymmetry based on the limited number of specimens that we have. And I'm worried about the morphology, what our limited findings are compared to what's in the literature on morphology. So it's all this is we're just sticking our toes in the water with this project. We'd like to develop a catalog of blind cave fish or tropomorphic fish, or even things other than fish. And then when we have some numbers to play with, this concept of the eyes migrating to the toward the dorsal midline is interesting to me too. We've got that now in at least two Congo specimens, and yet in the Mexican cavefish that doesn't seem to be an element. So I'm hoping that there will be some trends and morphological clues that will be of interest.
I had a question. Because you're able to transplant the eye and it was sustained in the blind fish, has there been any attempts to recover the lens in the blind fish?
You mean the transplanted lens?
Oh, I mean just...
Oh, you mean after the transplant, take the lens out and...
Well, I mean in the blind fish... I don't know if there's understanding of the mechanisms involved with the degeneration of the lens. But there's been an attempt to have the lens develop in the blind fish.
Rosie, can you steer the
lens?
I
can see.
Right. So putting it in the blind fish, I don't know those experiments, so sorry. Yes, sir.
Oh, I had a question about you talked about the study. I know it wasn't your study, but the one talking about for the 30 days in the light, 30 dark, and the changes between the eyes.
Right.
So did they go into much detail about that as far as what they saw? Was it photoreceptor degeneration or dysgenesis, or did they just not see the retina develop? And I know in a lot of our patients in dogs sometimes with, let's say, for one of cataracts, that they develop a deprivation of amblyopia, where even if you do surgery, they will never regain vision because those connections to the brain are developing. So I don't know if there are conclusions on that, where that this is an evolutionary thing, or this is just a disuse, so it never developed.
Right.
So what were their conclusions that they came to?
What they wanted to say that it was, what they showed in the pictures was relative size. They didn't do histology on these specimens, which is a major problem. And I'm in the process of trying to find out if someone has carried that experiment to the level of looking at the retina, looking at the photoreceptors, looking at the wiring, so to speak. So that hasn't been done, really. The point of that particular review that talked about that was just that environment has a big effect, which is a big surprise. But they were more detailed than that. So you could see the eyes were smaller in the dark, larger in the light. That's about it. So, sorry.
Thank you very much.